Good afternoon, Mrs. You're listening to 3CR, of course, on a week where we're looking for subscribers, but this is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here to defend and promote public education. And we've never been in a time when we were more needed. So we have a press release, 1061, and we're going to tell you about what the Australian, Victorian branch of the Australian Education Union are doing about the lack of funding in our public education system. They have a petition up. Let's hear a bit more about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1061. The Victorian Education Union has a petition to sign on Victorian public education cuts. Victorian public schools are the lowest funded in Australia. Trevor Cobbold from Save Our Schools has exposed the facts and figures on his website, and The Age and the Australian newspapers have taken up his research. But the Victorian Premier has walked away from her promise to fix this. The Victorian branch of the Australian Education Union has taken up the cause. Every school in the state is affected. That means the learning and well-being of every student is negatively impacted. In January 2025, Premier Jacinta Allan signed an agreement with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to deliver full funding to public schools. This was cause for celebration, especially during a chronic teacher shortage. But what the Premier didn't say was that her government had already decided not to pass on any additional funding until 2031, effectively cutting $2.4 billion from our schools. Victoria is the only state or territory in Australia that does not have arrangements to deliver fair funding. This is unacceptable. Funding delayed is funding denied. Why is this important? Every student's learning and well-being is at risk when schools don't have the resources to meet the diverse needs of all learners, including more support for teachers and education support staff. Teacher shortages will only worsen, and support staff and school leaders will remain undervalued unless the state government invests in the profession. It's about fairness and the futures of children and young people who deserve properly funded public schools, not a government that shirks its responsibility while calling Victoria the education state. Victorian teachers and parents are calling on Premier Allan and Treasurer Symes to keep their full funding promise and reverse the decision to delay $2.4 billion worth of resources for our schools. They invite supporters of public education to sign their petition and send a clear message to the Premier and the Treasurer. They won't accept Victorian public schools being the lowest funded in the country. Children and young people and their families, teachers, education support staff and school leaders deserve better than that. The AEU have an online petition happening at the moment, so we thought we would share it with you. And that's at https://themegaphone.org.au petitions stop Victoria's public school funding cuts. And back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy, and please get onto our website at www.adocs.info, or else you can go to the AEU website and sign that petition. Now, up in New South Wales, the president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation has decided that perhaps it was time we were reminded about why we have a public education system. It's for the nation's common good. And Dale's going to tell us a bit more about it. Over to you, Dale.
Thank you, Jean. This is a press release written by the president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation. Strengthening a public good for the nation's common good. In the wake of the Bondi terror attacks, it's very easy to overlook our strengths as a nation. That was a horrific day, one of the worst in recent Australian history. In the immediate aftermath, many of us wondered whether our better angels would triumph or whether we would degenerate into religious and ethnic tension. But for the tens of thousands of New South Wales public school teachers resuming classes this week, the resilience and robustness of Australian society came as no surprise. We see the great cultural melting pot in action every day. For decades, we've watched child refugees, recent migrants, and Indigenous kids scale heights that once seemed insurmountable. Today, that legacy continues in classrooms, where over one in three students come from homes where a language other than English is spoken. we see kids from war-torn countries take their place among fifth-generation Anglo kids, whether in an English class or on the sporting field, quickly finding their place and a purpose in their new home. Many fate the great miracle of Australian multiculturalism, but really, it's not much of a miracle at all when you think about it. It's actually the result of tireless work and dedication. It's a terrific return on investment in our public sector, creating an inclusive and humanising effect of shared spaces where every child, regardless of background, is valued equally. Public schools are the primary institution where social inclusion is built in this country. They're where difference becomes accepted as the norm, where prejudice breaks down through daily interaction, and where Australian identity is forged not through rhetoric, but through shared experience. When children learn together, play together, and grow together, they develop bonds that transcend the divisions adults too often construct. Yet we have to defend this precious and delicate alchemy. The relentless push for choice in education sounds appealing in theory, but in practice, it is driving a process of social division, underfunding the public school system responsible for serving all, and overfunding the private alternatives established on a basis of excluding many, weakens social inclusion and widens the socioeconomic gap across our communities. We welcome the joint committee by the Albanese and Minns governments to set public schools on a path to full funding. It will make a massive difference to every public school. And not too soon. After decades of the accelerated overfunding of private education at the expense of the public system, spearheaded by John Howard and continued by Conservative governments that followed, a funding regime that divided communities rather than uniting them. Accordingly, Australia now has one of the most segregated school systems in the developed world, according to OECD data. Families feel there is a choice to be made to secure a quality education for their children. This is really coercion, dressed up in market language. The result is a vicious cycle. As resources flow to private schools through unjustified government subsidies, public schools are left to do more with less. Currently, a staggering 98% of public schools in Australia are funded below the Schooling Resource Standard, the SRS, the minimum level agreed upon by governments as necessary to meet student needs. Meanwhile, the vast majority of private schools meet or exceed that 100% threshold. This is a fundamental betrayal of the Australian social compact. Public services should be first class for everyone, not a safety net for those who can't afford better, but the standard to which we all aspire. As a nation, we are all wealthier, happier, and more cohesive when we advance together. The countries that consistently outperform all other OECD countries in education, Estonia and Singapore, share a common characteristic: strong, well-funded public education systems that serve the vast majority of students. They understand that excellence is not achieved by creating hierarchies or dividing communities, but by ensuring every school has the resources to deliver outstanding outcomes. When we fully fund public schools so that all kids get a good start in life, everyone benefits. The engineer's child and the cleaner's child sit side by side, building relationships that will serve them throughout their lives. This is how functioning democracies are built. As students return to school this week, they'll enter classrooms more diverse than at any point in our history, taught by teachers who understand their work extends beyond literacy and numeracy, is inclusive of the development of critical and creative thinking, and builds the shared understanding that makes true democracy possible. This is the Australia that works. This is the return on investment that previous generations made in public services. If we want that resilience to continue, if we want future generations to respond to crisis with the same solidarity we saw at Bondi, we need to properly support public institutions that make social inclusion and cohesion possible. The choice we face is between a society where we value and uphold excellent public services for everyone, or one where we're divided into those who can afford to opt out and those left behind. Our teachers see the stakes every day. Back to you, Jean.
Thank you very much for that, Dale. And if people wanted to be persuaded about how important it is at the moment and how bad the figures are, then even The Age has been quoting the figures of Trevor Cobbold. It's not just the dogs and the AAU. Even The Age realises that there is something very wrong. And perhaps they're a bit concerned too, of course. Everybody's a bit concerned about why people aren't having children anymore. But let's have a break, shall we?
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Over five decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
We hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program because Sorrel has got a very interesting article in which she's telling us that teachers are spending $175 million of their own money to keep their classrooms running. Over to you, Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article was originally published by the Australian Education Union and is entitled Teachers Spending $175 Million of Their Own Money to Keep Classrooms Running. Australian public school teachers are spending more than $175 million of their own money each year on basic classroom supplies, exposing the personal impact of chronic underfunding of public schools, according to new data from the AEU. Or the Australian Education Union. The AEU's 2025 State of Our Schools survey of more than 10,000 public school teachers found that more than 86% of teachers are using their own money to purchase supplies for their classrooms, spending an average of almost $1,000 each year. Nationally, this amounts to nearly $177 million annually, with teachers in primary, special, and very remote schools spending even more. AEU Federal President Karina Haythorpe said the findings revealed an unacceptable reality for the teaching profession. The unacceptable reality, is that teachers are spending significant amounts of their own money on basic necessities needed to run a classroom, Ms. Haythorpe said. We're not talking about nice-to-haves or personal touches. Teachers are paying for basic items like stationery, books, classroom equipment, and materials to support individual students. These are critical items necessary for teachers to do their jobs properly, but they have been forced to pay for them out of their own pockets. The survey shows teachers are most commonly paying for stationery and classroom equipment, as well as items to support individual students and library resources. Teachers in remote areas faced the highest average out-of-pocket costs. Ms. Haythorpe said teachers' commitment to their students was being taken for granted by governments. Teachers do this because they care deeply about their students, but their goodwill is being exploited. When more than 85% of public school teachers are spending nearly $1,000 a year of their own money, that's not generosity. That's a system failure, Ms. Haythorpe said. This is especially unfair when teachers in under-resourced and remote schools are spending even more. The teachers who are already working in the toughest conditions are being asked to carry the greatest financial burden. With the new bilateral funding agreements that have been struck between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments, the responsibility sits firmly with governments to get this funding into schools as soon as possible. Governments must prioritise the delivery of this much-needed resource to public schools so that teachers aren't forced to choose between their own household budgets and their students' learning. And in the case of Victoria, where there is no full funding agreement, the state government must step in urgently and commit to a full 75% share of the schooling resource standard to ensure full funding is delivered to Victorian public schools, Ms. Haythorpe said. The AEU 2025 State of Our Schools survey was conducted in late 2025 and surveyed 10,384 public school teachers across Australia. Teachers were asked, do you use your own money to purchase supplies or equipment for your school or students? And if yes, how much money do you spend per year? The results let us know that 86.4% of teachers said that they spend their own money on classroom supplies at an average of $988.18 each. Average across the country, this equals $176,976,760 in total per year. Primary school teachers spend the most on average, $1,047 each, followed by special school teachers, $1,013 each. Teachers in very remote schools spend an average of $1,197 each. Teachers whose schools are in the middle band of socioeconomic status spend more than $1,200 each. Then teachers in schools who are in the low SES, $949 each, or high SES areas, $768 each. Teachers in self-described under-resourced schools spend an average of $1,119 each compared to $660 for teachers in adequately resourced schools. And what do these teachers spend their money on? Teachers were asked to select items that they spent their own money on. 85.2% of teachers bought stationery. 84.2% bought classroom equipment. 51.5% bought items to support individual students. 37.9% bought library textbooks or library resources. 16.3% bought sports or play equipment. 5.7% said for study trips or excursions. Very interesting facts and figures from the Australian Education Union there. Now back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much. Our schools and our children, our future is in the hands of our teachers, and we should value them, we should pay them properly, and we should not have them having to use their own money to keep classrooms going. Isn't that an indictment on our governments? But we here on 3CR, we can take their part, and we can tell you when there is industrial action and getting behind the teachers. That's what 3CR is for. And our schools, of course, are so terribly important because they can even hold the key to making the social media ban stick. And Andy's going to tell us about that.
Thanks, Jean. Why schools hold the key to making the social media ban stick. And this was written by Brett Hennebury and published in The Educator on the 9th of February. On December 10, 2025, Australia's social media age restriction law officially came into effect, restricting young people under the age of 16 from accessing 10 popular platforms: TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Threads, X, Snapchat, Twitch, Kick, Reddit, and YouTube. The restrictions, which were passed in the Senate in November 2024, aim to protect young Australians from pressures and risks that users can be exposed to while logged into social media accounts. While 4 in 5 Aussie adults support the ban, debate continues to rage as to how effective it will be. Professor Daswin De Silva, Professor of AI and Analytics and Director of AI Strategy at La Trobe University, says the ban's biggest limitation is the absence of a regulating governing body and the onus on social media companies to set up age assurance methods to satisfy the law. The federal government concedes age verification is complex, but says it has responded by placing responsibility on platforms, backing the rollout with guidance, enforcing penalties to drive compliance, and committing to review and refine the laws over time. Stacey Edmonds is a social scientist, teacher, learner designer, and deepfake safety specialist who has spent 2 decades working at the intersection of technology, education, and human behaviour. Today, she leads Lively, the learning agency behind the cyber safety game Dodgy or Not for schools and communities, and Fishy or Not for organisations. Her work now features in classrooms, boardrooms, and national policy conversations on scams, online safety, and AI. The Educator speaks to Edmonds about how schools can shift from reactive digital policies to proactive safety education, support teachers and parents through this change, and embed simple, repeatable routines that empower students to respond to online risks with confidence. The Educator asks, what does a social media ban for under 16s mean for schools in 2026? It means treating digital safety as a core capability, not a one-off program. By 2026, schools will need to move away from reactive assemblies and platform-specific rules and focus instead on skills students can use anywhere. That includes recognising social engineering tactics like urgency, secrecy, and pressure, and practising clear actions they can execute under stress. What actually changes in classrooms now the ban has taken effect? Less content, more practice. Short, repeatable scenarios embedded across subjects and year levels. One simple thinking prompt, is it dodgy or not, helps students pause and assess risk. From there, routines matter. Save evidence, block, report, tell a trusted adult. These skills need to be revisited regularly, not taught once and forgotten. What does this mean for teachers? Teachers shouldn't be expected to be digital safety experts overnight. Most are learning alongside their students in a fast-changing environment. Schools that succeed will support staff with shared language, ready-to-use scenarios, and light-touch professional learning that fits into existing workloads. Why does every school need a digital lead? Because consistency matters. Many fee-paying schools already have a digital learning lead or a team who can update content quickly, coach staff, and keep learning current across the year. Public schools need the same role to avoid patchy delivery and reliance on individual confidence. What about parents? Parents need reassurance and tools, not blame. Just because kids are home doesn't mean they're at home online. Schools should support calm, regular conversations with parents, using the same language and steps students are learning, so everyone is reinforcing the same messages. How should schools measure success? Not by attendance or completion rates, Look for behaviour change, earlier reporting, increased confidence, students being able to explain why something felt wrong, and knowing what to do next. As Albert Bandura reminds us, a capability is only as good as its execution. And back to you, Jean.
Well, we've come to a very interesting part of our program where our expert's taking us overseas. Now, we are going to the UK and the USA, but the good news is that we might have a bit of good news coming from there. Over to Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. This week we're going to do a couple of good stories for public education. One is hot off the press from England. It's in an online information site called Schools Week. And this article is by Lydia Chandler Hicks, and it's from the 4th of February, 26. The title of the article is Government to Update Collective Worship Guidance for England's Schools. The move comes after the Supreme Court ruled the delivery of religious education in Northern Ireland schools was unlawful. Here we go, and something which we think should be much more widespread. The article begins. The government is planning to update its guidance on collective worship in England's schools after the Supreme Court ruled the delivery of the practice in Northern Ireland was unlawful. However, the UK Department for Education said it had no plans to change the law, which requires a daily act of collective worship that is broadly Christian in nature. In the Northern Ireland case, the Supreme Court ruled the Christian-centric religious education, RE, and collective worship delivered in the country's schools breached the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR, because it was not delivered in an objective, critical and pluralistic manner. The United Kingdom's Department for Education, DfE, has now confirmed plans to update its own guidance on collective worship to reflect the current legal framework, including ECHR requirements. All state-funded schools in England are required to deliver a daily act of collective worship which is broadly Christian in nature. It says the current guidance is over 30 years old, but the Department for Education has confirmed plans to update the guidance, which dates back to 1994. Collective worship plays an important role in schools and helps encourage pupils to reflect on the concept of belief and the role it plays in the traditions and values of this country, said the DfE spokesperson today. They added government has no plans to change the law. However, we recognise the need to update the guidance to make expectations clear and the need for collective worship to be objective, critical and pluralistic, they added. We understand this is sensitive and we'll be working closely with partners and stakeholders to get this right. The Department for Education has not specified the changes it plans to make. Currently, non-faith schools can seek an exemption from the requirement for daily worship to be Christian in nature, while faith schools can provide collective worship in line with their religion. Parents also have an unconditional right to withdraw their children from collective worship, while sixth formers can withdraw themselves. There are calls for collective worship to be removed. But some argue that in an increasingly secular society, daily acts of worship should no longer be required in schools. Census data shows that less than half the population of England and Wales, 46.2%, identified as Christian as of 2021, a drop from 59.3% in 2011. However, Christians remain the biggest proportion of respondents. This was followed by no religion, 37.2%. Meanwhile, 6.5% described themselves as Muslim and 1.7% as Hindu. The National Secular Society, NSS, has long argued the law requiring daily acts of worship should be scrapped entirely. CEO Stephen Evans said, "Objective, critical and pluralistic worship is a contradiction in terms. The legal requirement for a daily act of broadly Christian worship in schools conflicts with the children's freedom of belief and is a relic of a bygone age that should be removed from the statute book. While we will engage constructively on guidance to make schools more inclusive, ministers should be clear that no amount of revised guidance can fix a fundamentally outdated law." So what happened in Northern Ireland? Article 9 of the EHCR guarantees everyone the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion. Meanwhile, Article 2 of Protocol 1A2P1 states, "No person shall be denied the right to an education. In the exercise of any functions which it assumes in relation to education and to teaching, the state shall respect the right of parents to ensure such education and teaching in conformity with their own religious and philosophical convictions." The Northern Ireland case related to a girl from a non-religious household who attended a primary school in Belfast. As part of the curriculum, she took part in Christian education and collective worship. The girl's parents did not wish her to be taught that Christianity was an absolute truth, but her father reported she began to believe that God made the world and she repeats and practices a prayer taught at school. He grew concerned his daughter was learning Christianity and not learning about Christianity. Her father challenged the legality of the RE and collective worship with a judicial review against Northern Ireland's Department of Education. The case relates not only to the school itself, but to wider practice across Northern Ireland's education system. Worship not conveyed in an objective manner is the headline, subheadline. This challenge was successful in the High Court in 2022 when the judge found that the RE and collective worship were not conveyed in an objective, critical and pluralistic manner. The hearing also looked at whether the parents' statutory right to withdraw their daughter was sufficient to prevent the ECHR breach. The judge found it did not, as it placed an undue burden on the parents, who were deterred from withdrawing their daughter over fears she could be stigmatised. The judge ruled the school's RE and collective worship breached the girl and her father's rights. Northern Ireland's DfE then challenged this ruling in the Court of Appeal. There, judges upheld the finding and religious and RE and collective worship were not objective, critical and pluralistic. But they disagreed with the finding that the parents' statutory right to withdraw their daughter was insufficient to prevent a breach of the EHCR. He said the state was not pursuing the forbidden aim of indoctrination. They also very much doubted that fears of stigmatisation or an undue burden on the child's parents would have been realised in practice. The family then appealed to the Supreme Court, challenging this conclusion. At the Supreme Court in November, judges unanimously allowed the appeal. They also dismissed a cross-appeal from the Department for Education. They acknowledged the parents' valid concerns in relation to withdrawing their daughter from religious education and collective worship. They also found the Court of Appeal fell into error in making a distinction between indoctrination and the state conveying information in a manner which was not objective, critical and pluralistic, describing these as two sides of the same coin. Conveying knowledge in a manner that is not objective, critical and pluralistic amounts to pursuing the aim of indoctrination, they ruled. So that is a significant Supreme Court ruling in the UK, which says that collective worship is a breach of human rights, according to the European Council for Human Rights. So let's hope that ruling spreads and less indoctrination occurs in public schools in England. Now, we're going to go to a positive story from the US today. And I'm going to ignore the overall look, but this is a small story from Mississippi. Now, Mississippi, I've done some research in the past and somebody challenged me on how much teachers earn in America. And Mississippi pays its teachers the least in the whole of the USA. So it's poor. It doesn't spend as much on education as it needs to. But this is one where they've stood up for the rights of public schools and they've had a win. In fact, it was an overwhelming win. So there was a move to allow more public money to go to private schools, basically. And over there they're called charter schools. And this is from Mississippi Today. It's by Davina Bose and it's from February 3rd, 26. And the article is, "The bill dies today. Senate committee kills House school choice measure." And it begins. The House's education bill that includes a wide expansion of school choice policies is dead. Its fate decided after 84 seconds of deliberation by a Senate panel. The Senate Education Committee met on Tuesday solely to discuss the House's omnibus education package that included a school choice program that would have allowed public dollars to go towards private school tuition and homeschooling. School choice policies, which give parents more say over their children's education by funding choices outside of public schools with state and federal money, have gained traction across the country and are being pushed by President Donald Trump's administration. It's a pet issue of House Speaker Jason White, a Republican from West, who has vocally promoted school choice in his chamber. But as the House leadership and proponents of school choice have continued their press reaching a fever pitch in recent weeks, Senate leaders have made clear they are opposed to voucher programs that siphon money away from public schools, so opposed that there was no discussion when the committee considered the bill. I'm not going to discuss it much other than to say we've looked at it in depth and this committee has passed most everything else in House Bill 2, Senate Education Committee's Chairman Dennis DeBar said. After DeBar, a Republican from Leakesville, received no questions, Senator Bryce Wiggins, a Republican from Pascagoula, made a motion to vote on the bill. After a chorus of nay from committee members, DeBar said the bill dies today. While the House has filed two omnibus education bills this session, both hundreds of pages long and covering many policies, a tactic also favoured by the Trump administration, the Senate has taken a piecemeal approach. The Chamber's Education Committee has passed many provisions in House Bill 2 as a standalone pieces of legislation, including raising assistant teacher pay and making it easier for students to transfer between public school districts. The full House convened immediately after the Senate committee's vote, but White refused to speak to reporters as he exited the chamber. "He's not taking any questions right now," said Taylor Spillman, the Speaker's communication director, waving a handful of reporters away while leading White off the floor. "Not right now." Later Tuesday night, White blasted Republican Senate leadership on social media and accused them of being in cahoots with liberal organisations. "We are not deterred," he wrote. "This issue will not go away. The Senate has anchored their support to the status quo. We are comfortable where we stand in our support from the White House, Governor Tate Reeves, most of our statewide electorate officials, faith-based organisations, business leaders, and the Mississippi Federation of Republican Women, and the majority of Mississippians." It's unclear how White will proceed. He was previously optimistic that the chambers would come to an agreement, but suggested in the event that they didn't, Reeves might call a special session to reconsider school choice policies. Technically, the chamber could try to revive parts of the bill by putting the same language into a similar education bill. The Mississippi Democratic Party chairman, Shaka Taylor, a representative from Starkville, lauded the Senate committee's actions in an email following the vote. "Our public schools are the cornerstone of every community in this state, and this unanimous rejection sends a clear message. Mississippi will not abandon its students and families who depend on quality public education, no matter how much out-of-state money tries to buy our legislators," he said. But Representative Janice Owen, a Republican from Poplarville, who helped author House Bill 2, told Mississippi Today that the fight is far from over. "Historic teacher pay rises, a historic increase in K-12 funding and a rewritten funding formula, elimination of the state income tax, every one of these major reforms was, at some point, killed in a Senate committee," he said. "Everyone ultimately became law. I look forward to continuing the debate and the fight for parental freedom." So I'm guessing that the forces for private education and making money from education are not done. But so far, you take the wins where you find them. With that, I'm going to pass you back to Headquarters of the Dogs and wish you all a very, very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Well, many thanks, Jeff, for all the research that you do for us every week. It's a labour of love, I know, but we do appreciate it. But we're going to have a bit of a break now.
Being a 3CR subscriber is vitally important to keeping us community-controlled, grassroots and on-air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Every 3CR show is a progressive voice that enriches and informs our communities.
From gardening and music to current affairs and First Nations voices, we broadcast expert community knowledge, offering perspectives beyond the mainstream media.
Subscribe today to be part of community-owned and community-controlled media.
Show your solidarity. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR, Radical Radio.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of a government-funded primary school education and of a government-funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit. Our education is not for profit.
You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
Well, we hope you're still listening to The Dogs. Here in 3CR, we are quite prepared to promote the arts. They're in short supply at the moment with people promoting them in our country, unfortunately. And we're in danger here of becoming Philistines. Let's find out about it, shall we?
Thank you, Jean. This is an article from The Guardian by Caitlin Cassidy. Australia is in danger of becoming an artless country as enrolments in creative courses collapse. Research suggests surging costs under the Morrison government's Job Ready graduate scheme and the axing of dozens of subjects is largely to blame. Australia risks becoming an artless country if it does not address the long-term decline in enrolments in creative courses, with more than 40 courses and degrees axed in less than a decade. New research published in the Australian Journal of Education found fewer students in high school and university were choosing to study the creative arts. At the same time, it found dozens of tertiary courses were being slashed. The research pointed to the former Morrison government's Job Ready graduate scheme as directly relating to the decline. Implemented in 2021, that scheme substantially increased the costs of arts and creative courses to cheapen STEM courses. Under the widely panned policy, the cost of creative arts degree programs for students rose by 19%, while arts, society and culture degrees rose by 116%. The changes meant that in 2026, a student enrolled in a Commonwealth-supported place for mathematics would make an annual contribution of $4,738, while a performing or visual arts student would pay just over double that at $9,537, and a humanities, media, or curatorial student would pay $17,399 per year. Professor Sandra Gattenhoff, who co-authored the study, said there had been a roller coaster decline in enrolments since the scheme was implemented. There's a disincentive for students to go into these areas, and it's not like they are big money-making areas, she said. We're heading into, within the next 5 years, a real reduction in the capacities to sustain a creative and cultural workforce. There will be an enormous decline in the amount of creative and artistic activity in Australia. The chief executive of Universities Australia, Luke Sheehy, said reforming the Job Ready graduate scheme was urgent and should happen in this term. It's hurting students with higher fees and pushing some young Australians away from study altogether, he said. That's bad for students and bad for Australia. Labor opposed the Job Ready graduate scheme in opposition, yet in government, it's ignoring clear calls from students, universities and minor parties and independents to fix it. What are they waiting for? In the 5 years to 2023, undergraduate enrolments in creative arts degrees declined at 30 of the 46 higher education providers included in the research, with some institutions seeing declines of more than 50%. Feeding into the decline in enrolment, the research found was a significant cut in the number of courses being offered. 48 creative arts degrees were discontinued between 2018 and 2025, in some cases leading to the removal of an entire disciplinary pipeline in a region or state. Creative departments have also been on the chopping block in restructures at the Australian National University, the University of Technology Sydney, and Macquarie. The picture was also dire at a high school level. The Year 12 ATAR enrolments in arts subjects dropped by 21% in the 8 years to 2023, the report found, with drama down by 39%, dance down by 38%, and media down by 25%, experiencing the sharpest reductions in enrolments, followed by music down by 16% and visual arts down by 14%. At the same time, there had not been a single national government initiative to address the issue, despite the Commonwealth pouring $75.6 million into STEM education initiatives to address similar enrolment shortfalls. Co-author Dr. John Nicholas Saunders said, if the trend continued, we risk limiting who has access to arts learning. We risk becoming an artless country. Gattenhoff said, under the current conditions, it was unlikely the federal government would meet the targets of its five-year national cultural policy, which aims to revive and diversify Australia's arts sector. We really do need someone in government to take up the passion to recognise that we are in a crisis and provide the leadership that STEM has had for arts, culture and creativity, she said. The Minister for Education, Jason Clare, and the Arts Minister, Tony Burke, were approached for comment. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, the government may not be putting money into the arts, but that doesn't mean that the young people aren't determined to keep the music particularly going. And I've got something special here. I've got a young man who goes to the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School. Hello, Quinn.
Hello.
What do you think about your school? Why are you going to this school?
Well, I'm from Tasmania, and in Tasmania, when I came into year seven, I started playing instruments in my school's band program. And I was inspired to get better. So I kept practicing. And by the time I got to year 10, I auditioned for the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School. And when I got in, I was super happy. And so I ended up uprooting myself and moving all the way to Melbourne to attend this school and living by myself, trying to finish my schooling and going to this really awesome school.
Quinn, so what exactly are you studying at the college?
Well, I'm doing my normal subjects, and we also have some school exclusive subjects that are only offered by my school.
And how are you finding that environment to learn in?
Yeah, well, when I moved to the school, I was surprised by how tight-knit it was. Because it's only got one building, there aren't many students, and so in the classroom, there's not many people, so you really get a very close teacher-to-student relationship, and it can actually be really conducive to learning, whereas in other classrooms, it can be very chaotic.
It sounds like the type of education every student deserves. Thank you so much for joining us today.
So there you are. The future is with our young people, and just because the government isn't giving money to the arts doesn't mean to say that the arts won't survive. So let's hear a bit more about this great state school, shall we?
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week.
State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of
the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School. Opportunities are available for talented young dancers and musicians to gain entry to the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School, located on the campus of the Victorian College of the Arts in South Bank, Melbourne. Prospective students can find further information on the school's website. Entry to the school is by competitive audition held in August each year. Positions are open to Year 7 to 12 students throughout Victoria, Australia and the international community. During an audition, a student's potential is taken into account as well as his or her talent. Music students graduating from the school are gaining placements at the highest levels and performing in many of the great orchestras and ensembles throughout the world. Dance graduates can be found in the Australian Ballet Company, Queensland Ballet, Royal New Zealand Ballet Dance Company, the Royal Ballet School London and the VCA. Dance alumni are also to be found in many contemporary dance companies. The VCA Secondary School is also the academic provider through referral to the Australian Ballet School, Gymnastics Victoria and Diving Victoria. Other elite trainers also study at the school. Facilities. Access to the VCA Library for Years 11 and 12 students and to facilities and institutions within the South Bank Arts Precinct. Curriculum. VCA Secondary School provides a training program supported by a high-quality general education to prepare talented young people for professional careers in music and dance. Students at VCA Secondary School spend half of their day in their academic studies and half of their day in their specialist area being taught by musicians and dancers. This means that all students entering the school have to be highly motivated in order to manage the heavy workload. A full performance program is a significant aspect at the VCA Secondary School, and students perform at a number of professional venues throughout the year, including St John's Church at Southgate, the Iwaki Auditorium and the Malthouse Theatre. As well as music and dance, the VCA Secondary School offers a full course of study from each of the Victorian Essential Learning Standards areas to Years 7 to 10 students. This includes English, mathematics, science, art, information technology, French, drama and humanities. In Years 11 and 12, students undertake the Victorian Certificate of Education, VCE, in music and dance and a range of other VCE subjects to complete a full VCE. VCE results in both the specialist and academic areas of the VCA Secondary School are excellent. All students study Vocational and Education Training Courses, VET. Accommodation. In order to accommodate overseas, interstate and country students, the school has developed a homestay option. All students living away from home come under the care of the Head of Student Services, who will work with the parents to ensure that students are given as high a level of care as possible. And now some facts and figures from the Y School website. The current enrolment, 344. And the ICSEA value is well above average at 1,141, representative of a diverse urban community. The upper 25% of parental incomes makes up 56% of students. The second quartile, 26% of students. The third quartile of parental incomes makes up 14% of students, and the lowest quartile of parental incomes, 3% of students, with 33% having a language background other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances. Recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $1.9 million and from the Victorian Government, $7.36 million. Private fees add $668,901 and other private contributions, $378,213. And that comes to $31,263 per pupil. The capital, $1.35 million over 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School, VCAS. And our time has come to go, so we need to remind you of the Subscriber Week. For 3CR, please subscribe to 3CR. It really is worth your money.
So 2026 is 50 years of 3CR. Your subscription is important from the beginning of 3CR, we've prioritised progressive voices, First Nations issues, local music, alternative perspectives, and truth-telling. Your membership helps us stay true to our values. We are not-for-profit, and a strong subscription base is vital to keep us on air and to ensure the production of over 100 local shows each week and the training and support of new volunteers, as well as maintaining our transmissions technology. So it all goes to a good cause. This subscriber drive, we're aiming for 1,000 subs. So if you have subscribed, but you know people who haven't, encourage them to become part of the 3CR community. Let's see if we can help get to 1,000 subscriptions. You can subscribe now by going to the 3CR website, where you can also set up a recurring subscription if you'd like. Or during business hours, you can call 3CR on 03 9419 8377. Or if you'd like to go in person to the station, go during business hours to 21 Smith Street in Collingwood.
And our website, of course, if you want to find out more about us, is www.adogs.info, or else for a podcast, go to the 3CR website. But from our wonderful producer, Dale, and from Jeff, and from Andy, and from Sorrel, and from Quinn today, and myself, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Over 5 decades, we've been home to hundreds of shows, thousands of broadcasters and guests, and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
This February, we're aiming for 1,000 subscribers.
It's just $40 concession, $80 full.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.